And now, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 2010 Pathopharm 2 Pathophysiology Pharmacology Final Review. This is the moment you've been waiting for. Okay. All right. So, do you have any questions? Amateurs. What we're gonna do is we're gonna come back to Pathopharm 2 course, and we're going to click on the So You Think You're Good. And we're gonna go through it. You should do the one for Pathopharm 1 also. So. Yep. So, what does Dr. Heyman say is the main thing that distinguishes nurses from candy stripers?
The knowledge.
Of what?
Disease.
Drugs and disease. It's coming up in a second, or maybe not. You guys didn't have to read the coming plague, but you should still know the answer to this. What prolonged and amplified the Ebola epidemic? Selfless nuns giving away free medical care. So if you don't know what you're doing, you can cause more harm than good. Said another way, Ms. Salguero, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I only wanted to help them. It's also paved with Justin Bieber. What?
There's a line in the 4 minute song by Madonna and Justin Timberlake.
Oh, Justin Timberlake. The other Justin.
I really love Justin Bieber.
I know you do. What are the four physiological mechanisms that control the flow of water in and out of capillary beds and normally prevent edema? Okay. Osmotic pressure. Hydrostatic pressure. You guys are like writing this down like your life depended on it because you've never heard these concepts before. Yes, plasma osmotic is the same as oncotic. Hydrostatic, plasma osmotic / oncotic pressure. Nope. Capillary permeability and lymph drainage. I don't know how you've gotten this far in life without knowing this stuff.
We're not really here.
Just kidding. Maybe you are.
Now, since we're here, let me ask you this question. What is the main thing that causes an increase in hydrostatic pressure in a patient that would lead to edema? No. Hydrostatic is the force of water. Increased water pressure. Fluid overload or increased venous pressure? That would be hydrostatic, yes. What would cause a blockage of lymph drainage? What's one of the common ones? A tumor. What's the most common thing that causes an increase in membrane permeability? Inflammation. I mean, I guess you could technically say cytokines and inflammation, but. I know. You always think that. Interpret the following ABG. PaCO2 of 31, pH of 7.33, bicarb of 15, PaO2 of 85. Start with the PaCO2, 31. Low, so respiratory, alkalosis, pH of 7.33, acidemia. HCO3, 15, metabolic acidosis. What's our primary? Metabolic acidosis. Are we compensated? Yes. Now, is it partial or complete?
Partial.
It's partial, because 7.33 is less than 7.35, which is the normal range. So we have compensated, compensated metabolic acidosis. And what about our PaO2? What's normal? Above 80. Not percent, you're not O2 sat in here, you're PaO2. Greater than 80. So 85 is normal oxygenation. Two possible causes of that particular ABG pattern. Metabolic acidosis. All right, vomiting could cause it. What else?
Diarrhea
could cause it. What else could cause it? Say again? Diabetes. Diabetic ketoacidosis could cause it. What would the patient look like if you saw them? What would they look like? They'd be breathing what? Faster and deeper. Perhaps Kussmaul breathing. How can you tell? What makes you think that?
Because they're trying to breathe off the extra.
Because the PaCO2 is low, which means they're breathing more than usual. Now, you might not notice it. They might just be breathing deeper than usual and faster. Why is that patient mad at me? He's really mean. Gaffigan. Gaffigan does. Interpret this ABG. PaCO2 is 65. pH is 7.33. H bicarb is 34. PaO2 is 45. So PaCO2 of 65, what are we going to have?
Respiratory
acidosis. pH is 7.33. Acidemia. And bicarb of 34?
Metabolic
alkalosis. So which one is our primary?
Respiratory.
So are we compensated?
Yes.
And is it complete? 7.33? It's partial. So we have partially compensated respiratory acidosis. And PaO2 is 45. What's that? It's low. What's the word for that? Hypoxemia. And how low is it? Less than 50, which makes it respiratory failure. What does this patient need?
Oxygen.
What else does this patient need? They need to blow off some CO2. What would be a good medication to give this patient most likely? Not Lasix. Let's not give them epis to start with. Let's start with something like, a bronchodilator. Great, give me one.
Albuterol.
Now there's a drug to give. Oxybutynin? No. The patient might need that for their incontinence, but I don't know if they're incontinent or not. Not enough information from that ABG. So what three complications should a patient with that ABG be monitored for? Well, I already have respiratory failure. PaCO2 is high. What's another word for high PaCO2?
Hypercapnia.
What does a patient with hypercapnia get? Cerebral artery dilation, which causes?
Increased
cranial pressure, which could cause them to go to sleep and possibly never wake up again. So this patient should have their brain level consciousness checked. And if they're sleeping comfortably in the middle of the day, we should probably try and wake them up. They can go back to sleep if they want to, but we need to make sure that they're not comatose. What else should this patient be monitored for? Patient's got acidemia. High potassium. Monitor them for high potassium. And what can high potassium cause? Dysrhythmias. How would you monitor for that? ECG or EKG if you are Russian. List the possible cause of that ABG above. All right, COPD is probably a good guess. Patients retaining CO2, and they have and so much that they're actually low on oxygen. So respiratory illnesses are almost always your cause there. All right, list four types of hypersensitivity reactions and a very brief description of their pathophysiology and an example of each one. What's type one?
Anaphylactic
type or vasoactive. What causes it? IgE antibodies insert themselves into eosinophils and mast cells when they are stimulated with their antigen, the allergen. You get a massive release of, say that word again?
Histamine.
Give us an example. Hives, asthma, bee stings, some food allergies, the more severe, like kill you food allergies. Type 2, what's type 2 called? Cytotoxic. Are you happy that's on the podcast now? No, it doesn't. Cytotoxic. All right, what is the pathophysiology of cytotoxic? Antibodies are produced that attacks your own body. So, give us an example. All right, type 1 diabetes, where your body attacks its own pancreas. Beta cells?
Not arthritis.
No, not arthritis.
Not
HIV. No.
HIV.
Not HIV.
Lupus.
Not lupus.
That's three.
Blood transfusion reactions.
No.
Although technically, I guess it's donated blood, but it's part of you now. Yeah, diabetes is like the classic one. Type 3, the immune complex. So pathophysiology, an antibody and an antigen together travel somewhere else in the body, and the inflammation that that brings with it causes damage elsewhere in the body. So some examples. Okay, systemic lupus erythematosus. What else? Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And for those of you who knew Sibel Seeds, you know, she actually had Stevens-Johnson's as part of her chemotherapy when she was undergoing cancer treatment. Some other ones. Like all the ones you were just saying a second ago were almost all type 3. Rheumatoid arthritis. Most food allergies are actually type 3, not the ones that kill you, but, you know, the ones that are more mild. No, it's not subjective.
Well, if you eat something that makes you, like, swell up a lot and can close your throat, that's different than a rash on, like, your arm because you eat something. Okay. Thanks, Carolyn.
Anytime. Oh, wait, I'm not Carolyn. Yeah, what she said. And type 4. What's the word for it? Cell-mediated. And anytime you hear cell-mediated, you should think of what kind of cells? T-cells. So T-cells direct macrophages to attack something, which causes a hypersensitivity reaction. So give us some examples. All right, base metals. So if you're allergic to cheap jewelry, so for that matter, any contact dermatitis, so like reaction to poison ivy.
Does that happen in your ears then?
Yes, that would be in your ears, usually with the cheap jewelry, but I guess it could be your neck or
your ring.
Yeah, wherever the jewelry is touching.
Okay.
What else? Transplant rejection is another one. Those are all good to know.
Why is transplant rejection that, but then transfusion reaction is the other one?
Because transfusion reaction is type 2. You're producing antibodies against the new blood. You could, but it's still a type 4. It's the difference is in transplant rejection, it develops typically over time, whereas a transfusion reaction is typically much quicker. And the main problem in blood transfusion reaction is antibodies. The main problem in transplant rejection is T cells attacking that organ. But it's just the way it is. I can't help you with that. Just accept it and move on. I know I did. My name is Dr. Heyman, and I've accepted this issue. Next one. List the drugs that comprise the MI standard of care and how each one improves the MI pathophysiology.
Mona.
Now, for those of you who said Mona, you only got 4 of the 7 drugs. So, in addition to Mona, we also have ACE inhibitors and beta blockers. Bum, 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 bum. ABGs is not a drug. Nope, not. Statins, my friend. All right, so let's start with Mona, since you said Mona. What is the M?
Morphine.
How does it help the pathophysiology? It reduces pain, which reduces sympathetic response. What else does morphine do? Say it again. It causes venous dilation, which reduces preload, which reduces the work of the heart. Oh, oxygen. How does that help? Make sure whatever blood is pumping is fully oxygenated, which reduces demand for cardiac output. Also, oxygen tends to help people feel less anxious, which reduces sympathetic response. N, nitroglycerin, or nitrates in general. How do they work? Vasodilation and venous dilation reduces the contractility needed to pump blood and also reduces preload, which reduces contractility. Yeah. So nitroglycerin works by lowering the amount of force and F work the heart has to do to pump blood. What about A? Aspirin. And if you had to give just one of these first, which one should it be? The aspirin. How does aspirin work? Okay, reduces platelet aggregation, which makes sure that the clot doesn't grow bigger. All right, then, ACE inhibitors, how do they work? They block ACE. That's great. They inhibit the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone cascade, which causes vasodilation, which makes it easier to pump blood, reducing the workload of the heart, and also prevents the negative effects of aldosterone, which can cause remodeling of the heart and arteries. Beta blockers, how do they work? Slows down the heart, reduces contractility, which makes the heart work less, preserving heart function. And the other thing that they do is they're also an antidysrhythmic. And what's the number one cause of death 72 hours after, within the next 72 hours? Dysrhythmia. So it helps to prevent dysrhythmic death. And then finally, we have statins. How do they work?
They decrease cholesterol.
They decrease cholesterol, but that is not how they work in this particular situation. they actually stabilize the plaque, and they also act as a local anti-inflammatory in the plaque. Now, as long as we've talked about those, what we kind of call the mandatory standard of care, every patient should be on one of those. Let's talk about some adjunctive therapies as well. What would be an adjunctive therapy that you would expect a patient who had a heart attack to be on? Okay, possibly Plavix. Okay, if a patient's allergic to aspirin, what could we use instead? Plavix. All right, give me another one. Think the big H. Say it again. Heparin. Or heparin's younger, studlier cousin, Lovenox. Lovenox. So heparin or Lovenox. Usually you're going to see a patient on one of those two, but they're not part of the standard of care. They're considered adjunctive. But you'll almost always see them also ordered. If the patient has had the heart attack relatively quickly, shortly in the past, what might they give the patient that could completely reverse? Say it again.
TPA.
Give me another name for TPA. Tenecteplase. Give me what TPA stands for. Tissue plasminogen activator. All right, what's a cheaper drug you could use if the patient doesn't have that much money to cough up? Streptokinase. Tenecteplase works a little bit longer than streptokinase. When I say a little bit longer, I don't know exactly. Like 30 minutes, an hour, not much longer. If a patient goes to the cath lab, what are the procedures that will be done for them? What would be the first procedure done? No. Angiogram. Map out the arteries, see what we got. What would be done after that, if they're going to do anything at all? Okay, a balloon procedure. And what are the two balloon procedures? Angioplasty and the S word, stent. If the patient gets either an angioplasty or a stent, what would be an adjunctive therapy of choice, an antiplatelet drug that's only given IV? Integrilin. Integrilin for Jackie and Shay. Oh, and for Natalie and Carolyn, apparently. Speaking of which, how do GP2B3A inhibitors work? So they inhibit the receptor that platelets use to tie fibrin to themselves, stabilizing the clot. So they work by destabilizing the clot. I don't have to slow down. This is already in, it's in the podcast. You can listen to it again as many times as you want. You can even slow it down to quarter time if you would really like to. I can speak well. So when are GP2B3A inhibitors used? We just said after stents and angioplasties. And what's the other indication for them? Ooh, I know. Just acute MI in general. Yeah, it's acute coronary syndrome, which consists of... What are the three major conditions that cause system fluid overload?
Heart failure.
Heart failure, liver failure, kidney failure. So, briefly describe the pathophysiologic mechanism of fluid overload in each one. In heart failure, what happens? Heart can't meet the body's demand for blood. So, the body responds with... Sympathetic response and renin-angiotensin-aldosterone. and also increased ADH. That hormonal whammy causes retention of fluid, causes the kidney to basically stop putting out as much pee. So the patient begins fluid overload. What is the best assessment for a patient who's got heart failure?
Daily weights.
Kidney failure. What's the mechanism of fluid overload?
The kidney fails to put out urine, so it accumulates in the blood.
Yeah, very good. Great answer. Liver failure, what happens? Liver failure, what happens? What is the liver? The liver's in charge of producing proteins, but in liver failure, it fails to produce enough proteins. So you start to have blood, water, from the blood, leaking into interstitial spaces. So the patient gets edema and ascites. So your body has to replace that fluid. And as the more it replaces it, the more it leaks out. So you have a patient who's got tons of water. It's just not in their bloodstream. It's in interstitial spaces. What are the six treatments for the following lab value? K plus of 5.9. So first of all, that is hyperkalemia. So six treatments. Let's start from the one that works the fastest and move to the slowest. Okay, stop potassium is not technically, well, I guess it is a treatment, but what if they're on potassium to start with? So let's just not say stop potassium. Let's just, the treatment is the first one. Starts with a C, calcium. Does it actually fix the potassium? But it protects the heart. Calcium gluconate. It's funny, there's a nurse who graduated from our program in 2008, and she just sent me a message on Facebook. We just had a code, and they gave this patient calcium. Why is that? And I'm like, oh, you're in trouble now. I referred her to my podcast. And she's like, this is great stuff. Mm-hmm. Some of you guys have met Samantha Strunk at Jupiter. She says she listens to my podcast while she runs. She always was a nerd, but I knew there was a reason I liked that girl. She's probably going to listen to this one now. Actually, I think she made her own podcast. She like recorded them. This is before the days of podcasts for her. Anyway. So, first one is calcium. Second one. Sodium bicarbonate. How does it work? It shifts the potassium into cells. Works about the same speed as bicarb. We have insulin, IV insulin. Anytime you give IV insulin to a patient who's got normal blood sugars, you also need to administer glucose. So we're going to give insulin plus glucose. And what's the cool name for glucose?
Dextrose.
All right, following that we have? You got K-oxalate and diuretics. What diuretics in particular? Lasix and HCTZ. Now, even though those will lower potassium, typically you're not going to give those to a patient because they have high potassium, because they have their own, so many other problems that go along with them. Yes, they will lower it, but we really shouldn't consider them a treatment for it. And then the last one would be, okay, K-oxalate, how does that work? Sucks it out into the gut, and then you poop it out. You excrete it in the feces, in the stool. And the last one, the one that takes the longest to work, dialysis. It is also what you would use if you have kidney failure, whether it's acute or chronic. Your patient is on IV Lasix. Number one, what is the major electrolyte to monitor?
Potassium.
What other electrolytes could also go wacky?
Sodium
and chloride. If the physician orders supplementation of that electrolyte, What is the major assessment you should perform before administering the electrolyte? What was the electrolyte again? Potassium. What's its letter? No. No, P, no K. If that potassium is IV, what's the max you can run it in, max rate? 10 milliequivalents per hour is the maximum rate that you can run potassium in. Can you ever do, that looks like the right number of drops for potassium?
No.
Got to put it on a pump. List a drug used to induce labor and the major nursing action assessment associated with it. Oxytocin. Got to check blood pressures. Because they can go hypertensive. Yeah. Water toxicity? What you're thinking of is preeclampsia. List the drug that is the antidote to, actually it's not the above drug, it's to preeclampsia. What's the treatment for preeclampsia? Magnesium sulfate. And the major assessment that goes along with it? Reflexes. What drug can be used to stop or slow down labor? I'll give you a hint. It is a catecholamine, terbutaline. Or what you're going to hear Professor Drum say it as is the brand name, Brethine. How does it do that? It stimulates beta-2 receptors, and beta-2 receptors relax the uterus. And it's not on here, but what drug could be used to ripen the cervix and prepare it for delivery? It is a prostaglandin, misoprostol, or cervidil. What is the difference between heparin and Lovenox? Include the kinetics, efficacy, adverse effects, and something. All right, so Lovenox is a more consistent heparin, which means that it's predictable in its dosing, so we give it twice a day, sub-Q, instead of having to give it IV drip continuously. We also don't have to monitor PTT. And it works better. As far as adverse effects go, very similar, except that there's a whole lot less of HIT, heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. It still can cause it, but a lot less likely to. As far as adverse effects like bleeding, well, gosh, it's the same one. But because it's more predictable, less likely to have them than a patient who's got heparin. Your patient has AFib and is scheduled for cardioversion. What assessment should be done beforehand and why? Say again? Oh, but that's how we got to know they had the AFib. He said ECG, which, I mean, yeah, that's okay, but. TEE, and what does that mean? Transesophageal echocardiogram to check for clots where? In the atria. Your patient with a history of DVTs is being treated for warfarin. His INR is 2.5. What do you expect will be done with his warfarin? Nothing. It is therapeutic. Don't ever say normal if it's high. It's therapeutic. It's expected, but not normal. Normal would be 1. The normal range for almost all problems is 2 to 3. for mechanical heart valves, depending on the protocol, it's going to be 2.5 to 3.5, or it could be 3.5 to 4.5, depending on which protocol your hospital and physician is following. Which brings us to the next question. Your patient with a history of mechanical heart valves being treated with warfarin. His INR is 2.5. What do you expect will be done with the warfarin? That patient needs it to be increased. Yeah, but still 2.5 is still on the low side. What does Rogam do and who would need it? Oh, you guys have never done this one before. Rogam is actually an anti-antibody antibody. It's an anti-antibody antibody. Rh factor. If you have a mother who is Rh positive, who is Rh negative, who's giving birth to an Rh positive child, their blood will mix during labor, and she will begin to produce antibodies against Rh factor. It's not a problem for that particular delivery, but if she has a second pregnancy, she will still have those Rh antibodies. So during delivery or before delivery, you administer Rogam, which hunts out those Rh antibodies and kills them so that the baby will not be harmed during childbirth.
That's if the mom is Rh.
That's the mom is Rh negative and the child is Rh positive. If the second child is Rh negative, there's nothing to worry about. It's not used, I mean, you see it quite a bit if you work in labor and delivery, but 80% or more of the people in the world have Rh positive, so you're not going to use it that much. But, you know, 20% of, you know, 4 billion is, I don't know, what, 0.8 billion? So it's still a lot of people who could potentially benefit from it. Interpret the following blood count. So RBC, hemoglobin, hematocrit. The patient is?
Anemic.
MCV, MCH, MCHC? Normal. Normocytic, normochromic. Reticulocytes? Normal.
What's reticulocyte count?
One or under. Less than one. Total bilirubin?
Normal.
White blood cell count?
Low.
So what's that called? Leukopenia. Polys?
Low.
Is that low?
Normal.
Lymphs? Normal. Bands? Slightly high, 2%. Monos? Normal. Eos? Normal. Basos? Normal. Platelets?
High.
No, what's... I forget you guys have new values. All right, so platelets are normal. So this patient has normocytic anemia and leukopenia. So what are the four possibilities of his anemia?
Aplastic,
hemolytic, hemorrhagic, and anemia of chronic disease. And we've already ruled out hemolytic. Why? Because the bilirubin is normal. So there's only three possibilities for this fella or lady.
Isn't hemorrhagic just the red blood cells and then the white blood cells?
Right. But the leukopenia could be from something else.
So you can have aplastic, not chronic hemolytic?
If you had a patient who already had leukopenia and then they bled, they would still be post-hemorrhagic. These could be different problems. They don't have to be related always. So it could be post-hemorrhagic, it could be aplastic, and it could be anemia of chronic disease. We have no way of knowing just from a CBC. Yeah? So the question was, are we going to have to do anemias on the test? Yeah! Like one or two questions, three questions tops? There's only 110 questions for all of your Pathopharm 2 learning.
Pathopharm 1.
Pathopharm 1 and 2 learning. Next one.
Wait, did you say there's like one third of Pathopharm
Yeah, it's about one-third pathoform 1 and two-thirds pathoform 2. So the next one, we have the same numbers up top. This time, the only thing really different is we've got lower platelets. We've got high white blood cells. What's the word for that? Leukocytosis. And we've got poly 63 bands 9. That would be shift to the left. What's the most likely cause of that?
Infection.
What kind of infection? Bacterial infection. All right. Give me some treatments for bradycardia. What's the most common treatment for bradycardia? Nothing. It's your question. So symptomatic bradycardia is what we treat, not asymptomatic bradycardia. How do we treat asymptomatic bradycardia?
Nothing.
Nothing. How many of you have a heart rate of under 60 right this moment? How are you being treated for it?
No way.
You're not, right, because we don't treat that. So if it's symptomatic, what would the symptomatic symptoms be most likely? Fatigue or dizziness or syncope. How would we treat it now? And whoever first person to say epinephrine gets my foot in their face. Go ahead. So epinephrine is obviously not the right answer. The correct answer is atropine. Why would atropine, not epinephrine? What would epinephrine do to their heart? Speed it up, make it pump harder, and speed up conductivity, possibly causing a fatal dysrhythmia. Good job. What else would it do to their body? Could potentially cause necrosis. So we don't use epinephrine to treat bradycardia. What does atropine do to the heart? Increases the heart rate. What else does it do? Nothing. So which would be a better choice?
Atropine.
Never forget this conversation. In fact, I'm going to record this and put it on the internet so you can listen to it again. It's that important. What's another treatment for bradycardia? It's not a drug. Pacemaker. Pacemaker. What is the treatment of choice for hypotension?
Fluids.
Who said that? Great job. You're so smart. I take back everything I've ever said about blondes. Well, yeah, I mean, it depends on the patient, but before we jump to dopamine, let's try fluids. Because what do they have to be to be on dopamine? Dopamine is a cardiac drip, usually patients in the ICU. And dopamine can cause renal failure, can cause a bunch of nasty things. So before we skip to dopamine, why don't we just try some good old normal saline? Acidosis, bicarb. And if anyone ever says, breathe into a paper bag, Anna's going to kick her, sir. Hypercapnic acute respiratory failure. What does the patient need? Needs to be ventilated.
Oh.
Hypoxemic acute respiratory failure. What does the patient need? Oxygen. And probably needs some help getting it in there. Mixed acute respiratory failure.
Both
of them. That was easy. What are the big five drug classes for treatment of heart failure? Hey, you know, if some of you would have done this before your cardiovascular test, you might have done a lot better. So, what are they? ACE inhibitor, aldactone, digoxin, beta blocker, and Lasix. Beta blockers. What are the two beta blockers we use for heart failure? Carvedilol or Coreg and Atenolol. No, not Atenolol. Metoprolol. Toprol XL or Lopressor. So, beta blocker, digoxin or cardiac glycoside. ACE inhibitors, give me an example. Lisinopril. And if the patient's allergic to ACE inhibitors, we could give them an ARB. Give me an example. Losartan or Kozar? Loop diuretic. Give me an example. Lasix. Aldosterone inhibitor. Give me an example. Aldactone. And I think that's all five, right? What is the major difference between treating heart failure in a med-surg unit and an ICU?
Dr. Heyman, that was a really tough question, and I don't know why you put that on that test.
Oh, I just don't.
The major difference between on a med-surg unit and an ICU. Med-surg unit, what's the main drug we give them?
Lasix.
Med-surg Lasix. Yes, you have. Why are we giving the patient Lasix? To decrease the fluid overload so that we can bring them back down to compensated. And what's that curve with the heart thing? What's that called? Actually, for you, it would be this way. Starling's Law of the Heart. Now, if the patient needs to go to the ICU, what would we give them? What would we do differently? Inotropics. Now, isn't digoxin an inotropic? Yes. But can we give that to a patient in a med-surg unit? Yes. Can we give that to a patient at home? Yes. So that's not the right answer, is it?
No.
So we need some other inotropics. Give me three. Levofed or norepinephrine. It's not. Dobutamine and dopamine. In addition, there's another drug we can give. Now say what you're saying there, Carolyn. BNP thing. What is that? Nisiretide or NatureCore. It's artificial BNP. It does not work on the heart itself. What does it do? Causes diuresis and causes vasodilation. And it's also an ICU-only drug. How can you tell the difference between left and right-sided heart failure? Where is the edema? If the edema is in the lungs, it's left-sided heart failure. If it's in the feet, it's the right-sided. Most patients will have both. Why would patient get Zyvox? I guess we've moved on now.
MRSA
is a potential answer. So it's a high-powered antibiotic, and it works against MRSA. What are the dietary considerations? It has MAO inhibition, so no foods with tyramine. Give me some examples. Chocolate, cheese, wine. Does your mom know you think that?
What?
Does your mom know you think that? That wine is anything good?
Oh, no.
I have you on podcast now. In pill form, what does it have that is also a precaution? The pill form contains an amino acid that some people cannot process, phenylalanine. So what patients should not take the pill form? PKU patients. List four of the CDC 12-step program to reduce vancomycin resistance. Wash your hands. Okay, I'm glad you got one of them. Say no to vanco. Don't use it unless you really need to. What else? Get an infectious disease consult. What else? Make sure you're not treating colonization. Only treat true infections. How would you know the difference? Signs and symptoms. You know, is it just in the wound, or is the patient actually truly infected with it? Do they have a high white blood cell count? Are they having inflammation in the wound? Are they having positive blood cultures? Do they have a fever? Yeah, those sorts of things. Make sure you don't contaminate your sample. Get an infectious disease consult. I get lost around 8 or 9, but you know, you can certainly get 4, right? I mean, you're supposed to be doing this stuff in everyday life of being a nurse, so.
We're nursing training.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Deficient as a trainee, deficient as a nurse. That's what I always say. What is the difference between Norvasc and Verapamil? Pharmacodynamically speaking and therapeutically. Pharmacodynamically speaking means what? How does it affect the body differently? Which one? Verapamil affects the heart and Norvasc does not, only arteries. So what can you use Verapamil to treat that you cannot use Norvasc to treat? Dysrhythmias. Can they both be used to treat hypertension? Yes. Can they both be used to treat angina pectoris? Yes. Can they both be used to treat dysrhythmias?
No.
Which one can be?
Verapamil.
What's the other one that can also be? Diltiazem or Cardizem. Name a penicillin that would be appropriate for treating Pseudomonas infection. What are the six penicillins you're supposed to know? G and VK, amoxicillin, piperacillin, and then the combinations, Augmentin and Zosyn. Which one would be the best one to treat Pseudomonas? Zosyn or piperacillin by itself even. But Zosyn is even a better answer. What drug class will enhance the effectiveness of albuterol?
Steroids.
Steroids. How does it work?
Inflammation.
It does do that, but how does it increase the effectiveness of albuterol? It increases the sensitivity of the receptors and increases the number of receptors. Okay. Why?
How does the steroid then affect that one?
How long does it take the steroid to work?
Probably longer.
Days. How long does it take the albuterol to work?
Immediately.
Right away.
2 to 3 minutes. So why would you want to use the albuterol first?
Because
you want it to open up.
It'll open up the airway, which allows the steroid to penetrate deeper.
Okay.
But you knew that. You were just testing me.
Yeah.
What is the foundation of osteoporosis treatment? Calcium and vitamin D. What do you think of this particular order? Oxycontin, 80 milligrams, PO, BID.
No chewing.
BID is an approved abbreviation. Oxycontin can last 12 hours. Yeah, this is a perfectly acceptable order.
We don't think anything?
You think it's good. I should give that.
Why would you ask that?
Most of the orders you're going to see are good orders, and you should give them. Because you have to know both. You work on a telemetry
for... What would be a bad order?
What would be a bad order? Oxycontin, 80 milligrams, PO, BID, PRN. You don't give Oxycontin PRN. You work on a telemetry floor. There's a standing order for magnesium hydroxide for constipation. What's another name for magnesium hydroxide?
Milk of magnesia.
Your patient is constipated. What do you do? How many of you want to just give it to them? What do you have to do before you give magnesium to a heart patient? Not reflexes. You're giving them orally, not IV. Check renal function. How would you do that? Okay, urine output is one way, but what's a better way? Creatinine, that would be a great one. If your patient's above the age of 60, what would be even better? Creatinine clearance.
But don't you do a 24-hour
without? No, that's the best way to do it, but you can estimate it. There's a little function. You can actually download a calculator for your little iPhone 4 there.
I'm going to get right on that.
Mm-hmm.
Has it.
Your MI patient has a MAG level of 1.8. What do you anticipate we've done for this patient? Nothing because it's normal? Is that your final answer?
Yeah.
This patient is a cardiac patient. They need to have magnesium of at least 2. So you anticipate that they'll be supplemented with magnesium. Don't you?
Yeah.
You're just trying me, huh? What are the major side effects of chemotherapy? Okay, nausea, vomiting, stomatitis, hair loss, thrush, leukopenia, anemia, thrombocytopenia.
Are you rapping?
Yeah. Infection, bleeding.
Bone marrow suppression is chemotherapy or cancer?
Bone marrow, it's primarily the chemotherapy that causes the bone marrow suppression. What is the formula for determining cardiac output? Stroke volume times heart rate. How do we determine stroke volume? Injection fraction times? End diastolic volume. EDV. Your patient has been diagnosed with an acute myocardial infarction. The patient is 176 pounds. The physician ordered the heparin according to the hospital's heparin protocol. Blah, 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 blah. How much will you give as a bolus? How much will you give as a drip? You can work that out on your own. I'm sure I have great faith in you now and your math ability. List the major drug classes used to treat diabetes, a representative example of each one and how they work and their major adverse effects. You know what's scary? Is the grade that some of you got on your first diabetes test, and that you guys are supposed to go out and teach patients about their diabetes drugs. I hope you have very good PDA skills. Or that you choose to, you know, go back and study it after you realize that you didn't know as much as you thought you did. Not moving along, I'm just saying, you know. If this is an awkward moment for you particularly, then don't move along. Absorb it. Internalize it. Learn it and love it. Live it. Oh, it says diabetes. So you have chosen the first drug is insulin. What are the major insulins? The short actings. What are the two short actings? Lispro and aspart, better known as Humalog, Novolog. Then we have, it's not quite short acting, but it's not intermediate acting either. It's Regula or natural. Then we have intermediate acting. What's the main one? NPH. And I don't know, the books always say Semilente, but to be honest, I've never seen Semilente used ever. So we'll forget about it. And then we have the long-acting one. Lantus or Glargine. Does it have a peak?
No.
It is 24-hour flat, but what's important about it as far as the way you give it? You can't mix it. And it's long-acting, but it's clear. It is not cloudy. All right, so we've done all those insulins. You have to have an approximate idea of timing. Approximate. So when should a patient start eating if they get Humalog or Novolog? They should start eating as they take it. Take it, eat. When should they start eating if they get regular? 30 minutes after. And when should they eat if they've gotten NPH? 4 to 6 hours later. So if they get their insulin at 8, when should they be eating lunch? Between 12 to 2. You should know the difference between intensive versus conventional therapy. So what is conventional therapy? A short acting or regular plus NPH. How often? Twice a day. So how many shots do you get total?
Two.
What's intensive therapy? So Lantus for 24-hour control plus Lispro or Aspart every time you have a meal. So how many injections is that? At least four. Depends on how many times you eat and how much carbs you eat. All right, as far as the oral ones go, what's the oldest one?
Sulfonylureas.
How do they work?
Pancreas.
Stimulate the pancreas to produce more insulin. So, what are three drugs?
Glipizide,
glyburide, and glimepiride, or Amaryl. Major adverse effect of that? Hypoglycemia. And it can also cause some other nasty things like weight gain and Steven Johnson syndrome. Wait, what? People with sulfa allergies should not take it. But remember one of the things we said about sulfa allergies. Patients will say they're allergic to sulfa and then be on Lasix. And Lasix is a sulfa drug. Or they'll say they have a sulfa allergy and they'll be taking Celebrex. And Celebrex is a sulfa drug. So you have to take that I'm allergic to sulfa with a slight grain of salt. Look at the other drugs they're on and see if they're on any other sulfa drugs. What's the other one that works by stimulating the pancreas? Meglitinides, right. So what's the drug you need to know for that? Prandin, repaglinide. How is it different than the sulfonylureas?
Does it not cause weight gain?
It doesn't cause weight gain. How long does it last? 2 to 3 hours. So we only use it to control what we call postprandial blood sugar. It's good for that meal and that's it.
And it's still helpful.
It can still cause hypoglycemia. Anything that causes secretion of insulin from the pancreas can cause hypoglycemia.
But no weight
gain. Hang on just a moment. No weight gain. All right, Professor Motto is going to talk to you for a moment. I'll be back. Not much longer.